Welcome to Business Lives by Vox Markets, the podcast that brings you closer to the people who shape the world of business. We give you an insight into the lives of the individuals who stand out from the crowd. For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning into the Business Lives podcast. I hope you're enjoying the new series. And if you are, then please leave us a review or a rating on whatever platform. And also, if you want us to get a guest on the Business Lives podcast that you'd like to hear from, feel free to send us an email at businesslives@voxmarkets.co.uk and we'll get that guest on the show. So today on the show, we've got Alan Greenberg. Alan made his name at Apple as Apple's educational director between 2004 and 2009, during arguably the company's most exciting period. His team at Apple developed things like podcasting, iTunes U, and the first generation of the App Store, initially in Europe and then in China. Since then, he's advised a wide range of companies and tech startups and is currently Chief Business Development Officer for a stem cell company, Wide Cells. So welcome to the Business Lives podcast, Alan Greenberg. Is it fair to say that you made your name at Apple? But before you went to Apple, I want to know a little bit about your early education, your early life.
Okay, well, I mean, how long have we got? 2 or 3 hours? When people ask me this question or ask me what I do, I have two points of reference. And one of them is the fact that I'm a shopkeeper. And what I mean by that is that I grew up in a retail environment and family business, a textile business. But that retail experience still holds true today. So the ability to identify a good store in a good high street, the ability to merchandise that store well, the ability to dress a window to attract people to come in, the ability to communicate with customers and to satisfy their brief. And hopefully those customers go away and tell 10 other people what a happy retail experience they had. Now that retail experience is as true today as it ever was. It's just applied to digital environments and global environments and literally the opportunity to scale businesses on a global basis. The other analogy I give, and I'm not an engineer, but I talk about being a F1 motor mechanic engineer and the ability to build cars that go faster and quicker than others. And I don't win every race, but we are world class. And that analogy, although it's not based on fact, where the first one is actually also true. So the ability to bring technology companies together, to bring API capability and supplement technologies, the ability to understand the challenges and the solutions that are needed to satisfy a client's brief and to build world-class technologies is as true today. And those analogies are probably the two foundation stones that I built my career on.
As a young lad, did you have any initial interests that you wanted to build your career on? Did you always know the path you were going to go down?
Exact opposite.
Okay, so why is that?
Well, because, I mean, I'm a little bit older than most of the people you interview, and the world that I live in was a different world than the world we live in today. And I would say priorities were different. So the ability to earn money, to be able to have a career was important. And invariably, it took me into rather an academic background. It took me into a retail background and many, many experiences, far too many to repeat in this interview. But the ability to interact with people, to grow businesses, to work globally, I mean, internationally at that point in time meant Europe rather than further afield, was certainly part of my early experience. And from a retail, predominantly retail background, I was one of the first people to get involved in e-commerce, one of the first people to get involved in mail order catalog businesses. So we had a business called Racing Green, which was a replica of a very successful business in the US called J. Crew. So we were the first people to bring that into the United Kingdom. I can't even remember the date of it, but it's many years ago. First people to look at alternative channels marketing, and actually building e-commerce websites and charging people copious amounts of money to do that. So I've been at the cutting edge of technology evolution, technology engagement, customer engagement, probably for more years than I care to remember.
So would you say that you're quite entrepreneurial when, if you've set up these small and been forward thinking, you must be a little bit of an entrepreneur?
Well, I've made money and lost money, if that's the answer to that question. I've had some successes, I've had some failures, and I think that's held me in good stead for certainly my evolution and the companies I work with and what I bring value. I mean, one of the interesting pieces, Will, is that certainly my value today is I work, not exclusively, but I work with a lot of very young people. And one of the things those young people are often missing is experience. So the ability to bring both success and failure, to bring experience of working in multiple different areas and different sectors to young, dynamic companies is enormously valuable. And I would think that in a time when investment money is becoming slightly scarcer and when there are challenges in terms of growing businesses, the crossover between having young dynamic companies wanting to develop their businesses and having some hopefully wise and experienced minds around is a catalyst to huge success. And certainly it's something I enjoy a great deal with many companies that I collaborate with.
And when you were younger doing it, did you have somebody that would that looked at you and said, yes, I want to invest, and kind of held your hand through the procedure?
No, I had bank managers, and that was always an interesting conversation. But I've been privileged to work with some extraordinary people. I mean, I'll give you one example. I had a furniture business, which cost me a fortune. That was one of the less successful ones. But I had the privilege to work with a company called Casina out of Italy, and even more importantly, a company called Vitsu out of Frankfurt, Germany. And Vitsu is a furniture company, which the furniture was designed by Professor Dieter Rams. And to anyone who knows anything about design, they would know that Professor Dieter Rams is one of the greatest living, still living, product designers ever. He's influenced Apple. If you look at the synergy between Braun, so Braun razors and Braun technology, and look at what Apple has developed, I know for a fact that Johnny Ive and Steve Jobs were huge admirers of Dieter Rams' work, and I had the privilege to work with Dieter for 2.5 years. I had an interest in Vitsu. I lost that interest in Vitsu, but the gentleman who took over from me, Mark Adams, eventually bought Vitsu and now owns it outright globally. And Mark has built a most extraordinary company off the back of that early engagement. And I was privileged to be part of that journey and privileged to meet someone who can only be regarded as a genius.
So you mentioned that there's a bit of a tie there with Apple. I know that you joined Apple in 2005. But what I want to know is, how did you get yourself into a position where you could actually join that company?
Difficult story to tell in detail, but let's just say the following. I have a relationship with a very senior member of Apple's team in Europe, and it's a close friendship that now has been established for over 28 years, a family friendship. And there was a luncheon conversation in the summer of 2004 in his chateau in Angers, because when you have the sort of engagement that this gentleman has, you don't have a house, you have a chateau. And in that conversation, we talked about the fact I was invited, would I like to come and perhaps do some work for Apple? And I asked what, and I was suggested I should look at the education business and how we did business in education, how Apple did business in education, to which I answered, I don't know anything about education. And that was actually a qualification for the position. What this gentleman wanted wasn't necessarily someone who was an expert in education, but somebody who was reasonably intelligent and trusted. Now, the intelligent bit is out for judgment elsewhere, but I mean, trusted was the important piece, that this, that coming into Apple, I wouldn't break things, but I might interrogate things and ask some pertinent questions, look at different routes to market, alternative ways of engaging, rather than just accepting that traditionally a representative from a major company, technology company, visits a university and sells some computers or sells some technology. I was asked to look at maybe a different way, a different process, a different type of engagement. And that engagement was the privilege that I was given and something that grew to an extensible operation within Apple and globally.
I mean, that's an incredible opportunity that back in 2005 you obviously got. And I can't imagine those opportunities come around at this day and age in terms of this as the company's progressed and the size of it.
I think the exact opposite. Well, I'm not saying for Apple. I can't answer for Apple. But I can say in terms of the work I do and people I engage with, I would say to you that it happens all the time everywhere, insofar as the word trust and ethics and finding the right way to engage with your customers is becoming increasingly more important. It's actually part of business engagement today rather than just anecdotal adjectives added to companies. So that trusted piece and being able to take on a challenge intellectually and in terms of business challenge and being able to shape it in the right way that it actually configures and supports the objectives of a company and ultimately the objectives and the requirements of a consumer. So I don't think it's unusual. I think it is happening more and more often. And certainly I get dragged into these conversations on a fairly regular basis.
I can imagine. And I mean, you were there at the height of innovation.
Absolutely.
They released the iPhone a couple of years after you. What was it like to be in a company where it was just so forward thinking?
I was there. Well, first of all, I was there when the iPod was launched. So the iPod was cutting edge technology. To have 25 songs in your pocket and then 2,500 2,500 songs in your pocket and the innovation. And we were one of the first people to look at how we could put other content than music onto those devices. I was there with the launch of the first iPhone. I remember being in the offices when we were each given our first iPhone. It was like Santa Claus came in June. It was extraordinary. And there was a long queue of everyone in the company who wanted their iPhone and wanted to engage with this cutting edge technology. But the evolution was amazing because we knew that when an iPod was released, it was already obsolete. We knew that the next generation was already in the cupboard waiting to be launched. We knew that we had to evolve content, if you like, that could sit on these devices and basically change the market. And we were motivated and we were empowered and we were great leadership in terms of challenging the paradigm and taking things on to a completely different level.
And that planned obsolescence is still obviously happening today. They know exactly the way in which the market's going to go and with the products that they're going to release.
Well, I can't comment. I think there are specialists out there who could make a better statement than I would. But I would say to you that even though the company is possibly different today in terms of the days when I worked there from 2005 through to 2009, I would say the company culture and philosophy has been taken forward and it's still, if not the greatest, one of the greatest technology companies in the world and one to be watched continually.
And that education department that you were in and your job role there, what did you know about other departments? Was it a mass element of secrecy going on between the different departments in the company, or did you have an idea of what was happening all around the company at any one time?
It's a good question. I mean, again, initially when I joined Apple 2005, the offices were based in Les Ulis in Paris. It wasn't until we all moved to Hanover Street, and I was, I think, the third or fourth person actually to take a seat in the Hanover Street office above the Regent Street store. But there were only, I think in my day, about 350 people within that organization. And these people were super talented. I mean, graduates from INSEAD, HEC, London Business School, Harvard, Cambridge. I mean, these were very, very smart people and very dynamic people. So there was a certain amount of intimacy that grew from a relatively small group, which is now much larger. Although business was siloed, so the education team worked independently of other teams, but I happened to be fortunate enough to work on the podcasting project and led that project. And podcasting obviously tended to drift into enterprise as well as it was in education. I remember briefing the Financial Times, where I sat in a room with the chief executive and briefed the Financial Times. The article that was written was credited to the chief executive rather than to me, but I was privileged enough to be at that cutting edge, to be at the opportunity of sharing the innovation and, again, the catalyst to an expansive opportunity.
So you led the podcasting team. I want to know more about that. What do you mean by you led the podcasting
team?
Well,
it's difficult to explain without getting into confidences, but let me try and put it into context. First of all, no project at Apple happens without an enormous contribution from many, many people, technical people, marketing people, education people. There's a number of different facets to it. But the way Apple works is a project will start with a systems engineer, obviously is responsible for the technology side of things, and it will work and also collaborating with what is generally called a business development and marketing person. So I was privileged enough to have the responsibility from a business development marketing responsibility. So I was there dealing with or developing communications, putting on events within Hanover Street and going and visiting universities and schools and basically evolving the marketing side of the business, working very closely with the technical team. So there was a joined up process. And it was a journey where many people contributed, but a number of people led that initiative. And I was privileged to be one of those people.
So is it fair to say that you and a group of others were the inventors of the podcast?
Well, I think I was the voice and maybe the face. I'm not sure whether being the face was the best opportunity, but I'm certainly the voice. And I was the point of contact between institutions and Apple. So things used to land on my desk. I mean, there are some funny stories, one which I think I can share. I'm trying to give the exact date. I think it would have been the summer of 2006. But Banque Santander has a foundation called the Universia Foundation. And Universia Foundation has basically money that would Santander would pay in tax available to be distributed or available for projects within the Universia Foundation. And the Universia Foundation focuses on both education and healthcare. And we had a call from the Spanish Apple offices that there was a board meeting on the Friday. This was the Monday or Tuesday. It was a board meeting in Santander on the Friday, and Santander had €1 million or dollars or pounds allocated that would go in tax money unless they could find a project, and they wanted to collaborate with Apple. To cut a long story sideways, the Spanish university team came to London. Only one of them spoke any English. We had to structure an opportunity for them, and that structure was to develop a podcasting resource for university to share with six or seven universities, predominantly in Madrid and Barcelona. And we actually, in order to communicate it, I assumed I would be allowed to go to that board meeting. And of course, I was not allowed to do that. And even the managers who came to visit us in London were not allowed to go to that meeting. So we decided to basically record some content. We translated my podcasting presentation into Spanish. I then went into product marketing and borrowed, I think, 12 or 13 iPods and a MacBook. We loaded the content plus some other assets onto those iPods and the presentations onto the iMac. Then the manager took that back to Santander for the meeting, gave it to his manager with his recorded video associated to it. He went to the board meeting, showed the video, and we had a purchase order for $1 million on the Monday morning, which was a fairly extraordinary set of circumstances. I don't think any of us slept for the better part of 72 hours, but an exciting opportunity. What is really interesting is that innovation and that disruption today has, I believe, something in the region of 4,967 universities across Spain, Portugal, and South America, and in excess of 16.8 million students. Huge success story, where the dissemination of content in Spanish and Portuguese languages has been shared globally through the Universia Foundation. Huge engagement. And I still have that relationship with the Universia Foundation and with Santander some, 12, 13 years later.
So was there a special feeling? I mean, we all do work in companies and we all think they're going to be absolutely massive and everything in terms of everything internally seems it's going to be global. But was there a special feeling at the early stages of Apple? Did you know that that was going to happen, or did it just come about?
Okay, so the truth is it was instinct led. I mean, we knew that there was value. I mean, when I went out and met with vice chancellor universities, heads of department and universities, head teachers in school, the same information or the same analysis came back to me. There was an argument about or a discussion about what does digital engagement look like for a university? What does it look like for a university department, for a school? So we knew there was interest in some sort of digital engagement. We also knew that there was huge expectation of students. Even in 2005, 2006, there were devices in their pockets that were demanding some sort of digital engagement. But did we know specifically what it was? Probably not. We had a feel for it. So the intuition was there was an opportunity. Quite what it was, we had no idea. And to give you some context, I have, I think, on my laptop somewhere, a slide from probably 2005, where I stood in front of 12 academics in Hanover Street and talked about, I think we had something like 2,500 downloads this month on podcasting and got a ripple of applause. So that's the summer of 2005. About 15 months ago, I was invited back to Cupertino, which doesn't happen too often, but it was a privilege to go back and meet up with some of my colleagues and friends. And one of my colleagues who I work with in London, who's now leading the podcast portal at Apple, shared with me that the work that my team developed at Apple has now gone past 10 billion downloads. And I actually didn't know how many zeros there were in 10 billion. So I went to Wikipedia immediately following the meeting, and I looked up and found out it's 1 + 10 zeros. I then got a piece of paper out and wrote the number out. And when you write it out in a piece of paper, there's a lot of zeros, a lot of numbers. And when you think back to 2005, 2006, and the evolution, the launch of iTunes in 2008, no one really had any idea or concept that it could grow to that sort of scale. But 10 billion downloads on podcasting is a fairly significant number. And to be a contributor to that number and to help build that environment is something I'm extremely proud of.
I can't have you sat here, Alan, and not ask you the question. Have you ever met Steve Jobs?
I shook his hand. Okay. I'm not sure he would remember that, but I met him in Paris briefly at an event and I was introduced to him, but he shook a lot of hands that day, so I can't suggest that he would know or even remember. I think I know that he knew of my work. I mean, that is categorical. I can't repeat those stories, but I knew he knew of my work.
And what was your take on his leadership? I mean, he's known for being quite a difficult guy in terms of the way in which he leads companies. What was your take on that?
I've been both sides. So, I mean, I can't speak of an experience with Steve Jobs because my relationship with Steve Jobs was two or three people removed. But his aura and his enthusiasm and passion filled it down to every single person in the company. I mean, every single person in the company. It was an inspiring time to be around those people, the people I work with directly, both in Europe and then in the US and later in Asia, because I went to China for 2 years and I led Apple's education business in China for 2 years. I mean, it was an inspiring time to be involved in the company, and all of that filtered from Mr. Jobs. I was also on the receiving end of something which was less pleasant, and I'm not prepared to relate that story, but there was always fair play applied. And again, even when there were misunderstandings or some challenges, there was always a process.
So what culture did he instill in the company?
Well, I think this came from Pascal Cagny, but something I still adhere to today. Pascal's philosophy, and Pascal was the chief executive of Apple Europe, he had a philosophy of zero complacence, which is a very interesting concept. So, you know, we drove a very, very successful team that turned over hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue, in fact, even billions of dollars of revenue, ultimately. And we had growth in, you know, high double-digit percentages year on year. This was a hugely dynamic time, hugely dynamic company, but there was zero complacency. However good you were or was at any point in time, today was a new day, and what happened yesterday was yesterday. So that zero complacency is a wonderful motivator. It keeps you sharp. It keeps you focused. It keeps you striving for achievements. So it was just an extraordinary period of time. But it wasn't for everyone. I mean, there were people that could handle that sort of pressure and that sort of opportunity and thrive on it. And there are other people, frankly, who were less comfortable with it and perhaps, you know, did not fulfill their potential within the company. So it's not an easy place, but it's a hugely dynamic place.
And your role at Apple took you abroad. It took you to Asia. I think you spent, what, 3 years in Beijing?
No, I was there for 2 years. So 2008, 2009.
And how did you find that transfer?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, I went to be interviewed it was the end of 2007. Spent five days in Beijing. I'd never been to Beijing. I'd never been to China. And I arrived in a city of then 15 million inhabitants. And I was completely overwhelmed by just the environment and the people. I spent 5 days talking to people in Apple. I was offered the position and I came back and turned it down initially because I had A, a wonderful position in Europe, and B, I was almost frightened or terrified of the objectives of up and going to Beijing. Then I had some calls from the US and I was sort of more or less invited that I needed to go rather than having a choice. And my ego was inflated by that opportunity, and I took on the challenge in the beginning of 2008. And again, extraordinary. I mean, a remarkable place to work, remarkable people to engage with, and an extraordinary experience, which I still have many, many friendships and relationships even today from that couple of years I spent there.
And what cultural things definitely stood out for you and workplace differences?
Well, it was interesting. So, I mean, with an Apple business card, effectively, you can get a meeting with anybody you want. I mean, literally anybody you want anywhere. But you have to go to that meeting and you have to be able to build relationships, build friendships, and understand the mutual needs of those conversations. But I was asked when I went to these meetings, there were inevitably two questions. And the first question was, where are you from? And because I was a local direct hire in Beijing, I would say I'm from Beijing. Well, I'm obviously not. But the second question you get asked almost immediately after that is, how long are you here for? And that's a very perceptive question. So if you're there to support the Chinese culture and the Chinese aspirations, if you help them to build relationships, if you're there with a commitment to support that journey, then you have a friend for life. If you're there as the photocopy salesman flogging them something, I would argue your relationship's going to be very short indeed.
And we say that Apple was obviously very forward-thinking back in the day. China is pretty forward thinking at the moment. Do you ever think that the Asian market will ever overtake the US in terms of technology and the way that it's going?
I think it's the wrong question. I don't think it's a case of overtake. I think it's a case of opportunity. I mean, one has to understand that, I mean, a lot of the business I do today, certainly for Wide Sales Group and for Wide Academy, is focused on the Asia market. I mean, in terms of Thailand, Singapore, India, we have major engagements scaling out there. we also possibly will have relationships into China and certainly into South America. So I think the answer to the question is that if you look at opportunities today, I would argue they are easier, and maybe that's not the right word, in the emerging markets than they are in the established markets, which tend to be more conservative by nature. So from a business development point of view, from taking on a challenge and scaling a business, I like emerging markets a lot, and I'm very comfortable in those environments, as are my team and as are the companies I work with.
And I know that you invest and you advise other companies. Do you tend to stick to the emerging markets then?
It's not a case of stick, it's a case of looking where the opportunities are. I mean, it doesn't mean you don't work with the established markets. I mean, I have businesses that engage in the United Kingdom. I have businesses that work in the US. But is that the best place to be looking? Is that the best place to be working? I mean, when you look at the Brexit argument, personally, although I might have voted to remain in the market, I'm very comfortable with the fact that we're going to be exiting the market. It opens up opportunities, which are huge opportunities for business. And I relish those challenges. And I think it's really exciting opportunities in front of us.
So what have you done since you've left Apple?
Oh, I mean, that's too long to even start with. I've worked with incubators, accelerators, and I've mentored companies on an informal basis. I've been involved periodically with a number of companies. One company I joined, I'm trying to think when it was, it would have been around about 2009. That company was ultimately sold to Workday. I contributed to that business. I've also had other smaller businesses, which have scaled less so. There's a portfolio. I mean, today I have an interest in a major fund, a UK fund called Eight Great Technologies, which is led by Lord David Willetts. David is a friend and a colleague. We have 14, 15 advisors, some of the top academics in the United Kingdom, and we have deep engagement in terms of Asia and specifically into China through the Eight Great Technologies, looking at a number of disruptive technology opportunities and collaborations with China. Wide Sales Group is my major job, is my day job, if you like. I built something called Wide Academy, which was built to engage doctors on a global basis. And the rationale for that was, or the assumption was, if you think about it, that every GP in the world has got little to no knowledge about stem cell innovation and how relevant stem cell or regenerative surgery is, because when they went to medical school or when they went to university, it was not taught. So we're providing CPD, continual professional development and lifelong learning for those doctors and on a global basis. We also have very rich content on the platform. So we're collaborating with universities and providing that content free of charge back to medical schools and universities. Equally, if you look at enterprise, because within Wide Sales Group, we have CellPlan, which is an insurance product, which is the first end-to-end insurance product which covers stem cell issues. And serious blood disorders. So that is not covered by traditional insurance. So we have a very dynamic company providing that global insurance. But equally, if you look at the market, insurance is predominantly sold through brokers. So I have a responsibility to educate brokers. If brokers are going to come to your house and sell you an insurance policy, there's probably a good reason they should know something about the subject area. Equally, if you look at core blood banks, there are 500 core blood banks globally. And probably there should be about 150 that are of the standard and compliance that one needs to have a consolidated business. So we support the core blood bank industry, we support insurance industry, we support the medical world. And if that's not enough of a challenge, we also support the public. So we have a platform which shares this content free of charge into the global areas. And we have consumers coming to our platform who want the trusted and authentic content that allows them to make decisions, sometimes challenging decisions, about stem cells, about those insights, about regenerative surgery. We are the leading platform in terms of providing that information on a global basis.
Would you say that it's fair to say that you've had a vocation in life in terms of to educate others? And that may have come from the one time, the conversation that you referred to earlier, from when they said, would you like to come and help in the education department for Apple? So would you say that that conversation essentially has changed the whole career path of your life? Due to the fact that from then, gone through your whole career and then flipped it on the head once you've left Apple and you've gone into an area of trying to develop and educate others?
It's a really difficult question to answer. I think there are others who could answer it for me rather than me answer it directly. But let me try and give you some sort of structure. I am privileged to work with some of the most talented, intelligent, ambitious people around the world. I mean, I have an interest in businesses that spread from London, Amsterdam, Berlin, Porto, Beijing, New York, and Palo Alto. I don't get much sleep. which is why I look like this. I mean, but the fact of the matter is these are hugely innovative companies with great aspirations and great opportunities to drive their technologies and their engagement. And I'm part of that family. I mean, who wouldn't want to be? I have more fun than anybody I know. I mean, literally more fun. I get to travel the world. I get to meet extraordinary people. I get to eat in great restaurants. I get to basically live a very, very full life. I'm an 18-year-old kid in a body which is considerably older. And that's because of the opportunities, and I would say the good fortune of, and certainly Apple was a major reason why I'm doing what I'm doing today. I think the ability to bring value. I mean, for example, I have a relationship developing with Henkel at the moment, and Henkel is an extraordinary company, and they are driving some extraordinary innovation. And the digital director of Henkel and I have become good friends in the last few weeks. And they have global aspirations, global opportunity. But it's about being inspired by people. It's being inspired by the opportunity. And also, I suppose one of the things that I have, my character is such, I mean, I did my Myers-Briggs-Feldman test some years ago, and I came out as something called a shaper driver. And I had no idea what that meant, but I'm the guy with his hand in the air in a board meeting who's saying, well, actually, I'll do that. And I didn't really notice, but when I look around the board meeting, very few people have a hand in the air wanting to take on a challenge. I mean, they're smart people, they've been very successful, but not everyone wants to build things. Not everyone wants to take on those challenges. No, I mean, I don't understand the word impossible or this can't be done or no. I mean, I think when somebody says it's impossible, I think that's a challenge. And maybe I'm a very stupid person because I quite enjoy those opportunities. I'm not always successful, but certainly those challenges are what motivate me and make me wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning inspired and wanting to write notes and get on my computer and go and meet people and do stuff. So I have a lot of fun.
So with the interest that you've got, do you tend to find that there's a similar spread of companies in terms of what they specialize in? Or are you willing to, like you say, take on any sort of challenge? Are they all tech related? Are they all stem cell related? Or is there a common trend?
Well, I think that it's important to be focused. So I believe I come to the table with a certain amount of experience in the education sector, having worked in the sector now for the better part of 13 or 14 years. I think I also understand healthcare or beginning to understand healthcare better, and I see extraordinary opportunities in healthcare. And again, I have some experience. I do get dragged into conversations outside of both those remits, and sometimes maybe I'm less qualified to give an opinion than others. But I think one of the things that's very important, certainly from a personal point of view, and anyone who knows me and has worked with me knows that I tend to be very frank, probably more frank than my own good. I don't particularly enjoy the politics. And again, when you work with multiple companies and you meet multiple chief executives, it's important that there's one story, not multiple stories. So I tend to call a spade, and I tend to speak my mind. I'm not always right, but I think that frankness, that honesty, that integrity allows me to go and develop things on a global basis and build relationships. And I prefer to be respected rather than liked. That respect has value to me. Being liked is less important to me, but hopefully there's a combination of both.
And would you have any advice for any young entrepreneurs that are thinking about setting a business? By the sounds of it, you've set up quite a lot of business. They may have succeeded or may have failed. But what advice do you have for young entrepreneurs?
It's a very, very good question. And again, it's a complex answer. But I would say this to any young entrepreneur: be ambitious. Don't be restrained by what venture capital tells you to be. My point is, building a technology company in the UK, you have to have a global remit. So you might build it in the UK, but come to the table with ambition to be global. Generally speaking, somebody comes to me with an app with 30,000 users is great. That's terrific. But that's not what interests me. I have an app company out of Brooklyn, New York called TinyBob. TinyBob has just developed a schools platform, which we're rolling out at scale globally. But TinyBob has 15 STEM education apps in 50 languages, already available in 150 countries and 10 million downloads. That's a serious engagement. And off the back of that, we can scale that into a schools program, which will engage with schools on a global remit. That's exciting. That's what scale is. That's what evolution is. So I like ambition. But with ambition, you have to come to the table with a plan. So you can't grow from 0 to 10 million users overnight. So come to the table looking for 30,000 users, but come to the table with a plan for 300,000 or 3 million users, and that's much more interesting. So don't be frightened by the constraints of venture capital in the UK. Come to the table with ambition, aspiration, and then there are people who help you achieve those objectives.
So one question that we do ask all of our guests is, if you were 25 years old and you had £10,000 in your pocket, what would you be doing? And by the sounds of it, you probably, when you were younger, you were always looking to invest and start something else. So if I can ask that question, if you were 25 years old and you have £10,000 in your pocket, what areas currently would you be looking at? What areas excite you? And what would you do?
Okay, well, first of all, I am 25 years of age because I belong to a stem cell company, but let's leave that to one side. If I had money in my pocket, what would I look at? It's a really difficult question to answer. I mean, I feel very comfortable with the companies I work with, and I invest my time and my effort into them. So that's the first place I would invest. And again, there are some new conversations developing in the last weeks and months. I was privileged to be invited to Founders Forum last week and spent some time with Brent Hoberman and the community he puts together, which was truly inspirational. But in terms of that £25,000 and where to invest it, I would say, okay, it's a difficult one. I'm trying to think of an appropriate answer. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of buzz around AI, but AI is data, and that data has been around a lot longer than the term AI. There's a lot of talk about blockchain, and I'm slightly uncomfortable about blockchain, but actually, I had a conversation with one of the directors of the Open University recently and looked at some of the work they're doing in blockchain, which is extraordinary. So keep your options open.
But I'd like to ask why you are quite uncomfortable with blockchain.
Because of the culture of blockchain, I mean, there are some assumptions. So let me try and explain this one to you. When I grew up, there were certain things that were the trusted networks in society. So the doctor was the person who would advise you on your health. So whatever the doctor said to you, you would trust his or her opinion. You would trust the bank in the high street because it was a big grey building with a big heavy wooden door, and that's where you put your money. Whether the banks should be trusted the way that we trust them, but that's the way society was. We're now in an area of disruption where maybe your GP is not the most qualified person to advise you on your healthcare. We're in a situation where the bank is not necessarily the best person to advise you or look after your money, and there's disruptions going on there. But that paradigm is not full circle. So there are challenges in terms of who we trust, who are these authentic networks, where is the ethics in business, and that's evolving. So I'm saying to you, there's a transition period. So I would be cautious with my investments, but I think there are opportunities all over the place.
I understand the trust issues, but one could argue that disruption in business and exactly what Apple were doing, they were really flipping things on their head and really disrupting the area. And I would think that my initial thoughts would be that you would be completely on board with the whole idea, and maybe not just necessarily blockchain, but that disruption within the finance industry. So.
I'm saying to you, yes and no. I mean, I work with venture capital, and in venture capital, it's very interesting because you're ultimately investing in businesses, but you're not actually investing in businesses, you're investing in people. So my point is the first relationship is with the founder, is with the chief executive, with the team he or she has put together. And that trust and that relationship comes out of that. So from a technology point of view, I know I can fix technology. I have incredible teams globally who are technology leads, technology architects. So I'm less worried about technology. I'm much more interested in people. So my investment is in people rather than actually in technologies, but in people who can deliver at scale, who can deliver globally, who have global aspirations and ambitions. And that's where I feel comfortable.
So if a young entrepreneur came to you with an idea, you just look at them as an individual before the idea.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to change them. I've got one company I won't mention where I've had to change the chief executive, the founder. He's not the right person to lead the company. But he was open to the discussion. He understands he'd be better in a chairman position. He'd be better driving the technology, and that a younger chief executive would be appropriate. So there you have someone who's trusted his advisors to help him fulfill his potential. Now, that's a really interesting debate. So would I invest in that company? Absolutely, because I think that that disruption and that ability to recognize the need to build a team and build engagement is something I would absolutely invest in. I'm working with an organization called HatDex out of Warwick University in Cambridge, which is a £10 million research project, which is now becoming private service or private data. So the ability for people to own their data rather than the big companies owning their data. And that's an incredible company that's going to scale at enormous area. So there's plenty of opportunities to invest, but investments are risk. I mean, when you read your investment prospectus, there's a little note at the bottom and there's a qualification. So don't listen to what I say. But I'm privileged enough to be working with these people, meeting these people, having conversations with these people. There's huge opportunities all over the place, and you need to find the right ones to suit your pocket and to suit your opportunity.
Well, by the sounds of it, you've had an absolutely incredible career, and it's taken you into lots of different companies, lots of different areas of interest. And it's great to hear about what you've got to say. So I'd like to thank you very much, Alan, for coming on the podcast today. And it's probably great for you to see we're generating a podcast now, and you were part and parcel.
Well, as I say, I mean, I'm now a founder of Wide Academy. So that's a slight paradigm shift in terms of what I've done previously. So to build something from the bottom up is something which is a remarkable thing to do. But I'd like to thank you for inviting me. It's great to share some of these anecdotes. I need to be slightly cautious on some of the stories I share in terms of relationships I have existing and previous. But thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.